Well, as we begin our review of the divided kingdom as it relates to the northern kingdom, the kingdom of Israel, we want to ask a question, and that is where do we find this in the scripture? That is, where do we find the history of the northern kingdom during the divided kingdom? Where do we find that in the past? What chapters? That's right. Right? So we begin, and that's a good thing. If you remember nothing else, it's good to remember that we begin in 1 Kings chapter 12. Bonus points if you can remember where it ends. Where did we end the other night? 2 Kings, I'll give you that much. 17. Very good. I figured you might know that, Matt. So that's good. Yeah, so 1 Kings 12, 3. Would you? No bonus? Okay. He would have just gotten a demerit if he hadn't known it. All right, so 1 Kings 12 through 2 Kings 17. Now, what prophets have we studied? These are prophets. I'll let you think about this for a second. These are prophets that relate to prophecies made to, specifically directed toward Israel during the period of the divided kingdom. And in one case, a prophet who was from that area during the divided kingdom and prophesied to some Gentiles. All right. I'll give you another hint. There are three. All right, let's think about them. Let's take them in order. We studied Jonah, then we studied Amos, and then we studied Hosea. Very good. So that's our three prophets so far. And we're just interleaving them into the narrative as we come to them. And we'll continue to do that as we get into the southern kingdom. Southern kingdom's coming up, so it's good to memorize these chapters. So I'm going to ask you this question, even though it's a little bit unfair. Where do we find the history of the northern kingdom in the book of 2 Chronicles? Where does it begin? Well, it begins in chapter 10 and goes through 28. So it's pretty easy to remember. You only have to remember one book, 10 through 28. Good to memorize that. It's good for us to have in mind where these accounts are so that we, you know, when we're doing a study, we can more quickly reference them. If something comes up, we can turn there and get that. So a question, and really Paul's prayer addressed this better than I'm about to, I think, but why do we study the divided kingdom? I mean, we're not under the old law. We're under the new law. This is a history of God's people long, long, long time ago under a system that's no longer in place. Why are we studying this? Just some thoughts that you might have. Absolutely. We're seeing the character of God as he interacts with his people. And as his people today, we are learning of his character. I think about Malachi chapter 3 verse 6. I am the Lord God. I do not change. What we're learning is, as we study his interaction with these people, is a shadow of in how he interacts with us and with people today. Even with the Gentiles, we see his care for them. And so that's a key lesson. And just a few passages from the New Testament that direct our mind to this subject. For Romans 15:4, for whatever things were written before were written for our learning, that we, through the patience and comfort of the scriptures, might have hope. And so these things were written for us to learn from them, and that we are to gain that comfort, to gain that hope as we see God interacting with his people. 1 Corinthians 10:11. Now, all these things happen to them as examples. He's just given some specific examples, but they're Old Testament examples. And they were written for our admonition. Even though we're not under the law, we're learning about God and his interaction with his people. They're written for our admonition, upon whom the ends of the ages have come. And then this passage in 2 Timothy 3:16. Every scripture is inspired of God and is profitable. So it's profitable for us to study this, because if you think about it, there's God's interaction. We think of the Bible as being a lot of information, and it is, but it's also very concise. And it's, the Bible is our window into the heart, the mind of God, his interaction, his law, how he wants us to behave. And so it's profitable for us for teaching and, of course, for learning. It's profitable for us for reproof, for correction, for instruction, which is in righteousness. that the man of God may be complete, furnished unto every good work. So as we study these things, not only do we gain the comfort and the hope of the Scriptures, not only are we admonished by them, but we gain reproof, correction. We begin to become more complete and mature as God's people. So if we leave a section as large as the divided kingdom out of our knowledge, and there's just a big blank space there, then of course we're cheating ourselves out of this comfort, this hope, this admonition, and this maturity. Yes, sir. No, go ahead. Right. Absolutely. Romans 11, essential teaching for a Christian. So if we're ignorant of these things, we come to a passage like that, and he talks about the goodness and severity of God, we're going to be wondering what he's talking about. So we want to know those things. We want to be able to bring them in. Yes, sir. Absolutely. That's a very, very good point. It's not an intellectual exercise only. When we look at Jeroboam, for example, and we see God make those promises to Jeroboam, you'll rule over all that your heart desires. I'll build you a house like I did for David. And then we see Jeroboam come in there and gets into power, and he thinks, man, I got to look out for myself. And he puts God behind him, as God says. You couldn't wait to put me behind. You were glad to take the kingdom, but you put me behind you almost immediately. And then you took measures to protect yourself that were diametrically opposed to what I wanted for you. Well, what we see there is a picture of what we can do in our lives when we look at our life and we think, now how am I going to order my life? How am I going to do things in my life? God makes promises to me. Well, whenever I... what am I going to do with those promises? Am I going to trust God, or am I going to do what Jeroboam did? Am I going to put God behind me? And when I get into a bind, you know, I'll trust God when things are going fine. But when it comes to a hard decision, for example, am I going to continue a relationship with a family member who is outside of Christ? They have turned their back. They put God behind them. Am I just going to act like everything's okay? A decision's got to be made. That's a tough decision. Am I going to do what Jeroboam did, or am I going to act with integrity toward the Lord? Yes, sir. That's right. It's a very good point. There, we see a complacency set in among God's people. We see that complacency set in among them in Jesus' day. The people, we have Abraham as our father. So everything's okay. And so I think this is especially important for us as we, you know, hit our 40s and 50s and 60s, is we look at our spiritual life and we're not complacent or satisfied with what we know and the choices that we've made, but rather we strive to grow and not just go through the motions. I think going through the motions and complacency. I remember asking Miss Lee this question. You know, what do you think the greatest danger to the church is today? And, you know, I thought it might be something like marriage, divorce, and remarriage or something like that. She's looked at me without even blinking. She said, complacency. And it is a problem. Oops, I've messed up. Sorry. What was the root cause of division? Hope you don't read quickly. In a word, if we were to boil it down to one word, what would you say was the root cause for the division? Idolatry. And in particular, whose idolatry? Solomon's. Okay, so we see that here in 1 Kings 11:5. For Solomon went after Ashtoreth, the goddess of the Sidonians, and after Milcom, the abomination of the Ammonites. Then Solomon built a high place for Chemosh, the abomination of Moab, on the hill that is east of Jerusalem. And for Molech, the abomination of the people of Ammon. Therefore the Lord said to Solomon, because you have done this and have not kept my covenant and my statutes, which I have commanded you, I will surely tear the kingdom away from you and give it to your servant. I wanted to take just a moment and refresh. These names, sometimes they're just names to us. We are familiar with the wickedness that was back of them, but let's take just a moment and look at Ashtoreth. Ashtoreth, the abomination of the Sidonians. She was the moon god, the female counterpart of Baal. And you see how it becomes part of their thinking, their minds. She was this goddess of love and fertility. She was the goddess who was going to help, along with Baal, same idea, the male counterpart, of prosperity, flocks growing, herds growing, your children are healthy and lots of them, you've got food, you've got abundance. That's what she promised. All right, so it goes by a lot of these other names, Astarte, Ishtar, and Zerpanit, or some that come to mind from scriptures. And look at what was required here. Women were required to sacrifice either their hair or their chastity. So just wickedness right off the bat. Then we get to Baal or Balaam. He's the sun god. He's the male counterpart here. And we're familiar with the wickedness, this ritualistic fornication, the prostitution, and the impact that that had on the people. Just utterly degraded, their morals, they became a very wicked and reprehensible, repugnant people to God. And I think one of the most reprehensible, since I'm on R's all of a sudden, aspect of what they did is they credited these Baals with their prosperity when it was God who was trying to draw them back to Him with His love and provision. We saw that in Hosea. I think that's one of the most egregious things that they did, is they looked at what they had worshiped the Baals, and God is saying, look, this is what I can do for you. And so they took what God had given them, they ascribed it to the Baals, and then they offered it to the Baals. It's an abomination on a multitude of levels to our minds. It's just a wicked thing they did. And then there's Molech. And how do you even talk about this? This is just totally wicked. He calls it the abomination of the Moabites and the Ammonites. These gods were worshipped by different names among different people. It's also known as Milcom or Molech. I think Chemosh too was a name that's associated with this type of worship. And it involved human sacrifice. The children, their own children, they passed through the fire. And Solomon erected an idol to this God on the Mount of Olives. So it's just a picture, a very ugly picture of what his people were doing whenever they went. It wasn't just a trivial thing that they were doing this. And they were worshipped, Molech in particular, in the Valley of Hinnom, Valley of the Sons of Hinnom. And this is in the Greek word here, Gehenna, is the word that Jesus chose to speak of hell, of that judgment. And it's easy to see. You think about, we were created in the image of God. How far is this practice from that image? It's the very antithesis. God is trying to bless and to help and to be in a right relationship with His children. And here we have people murdering their children in the most inhumane way imaginable. It's just, all right, so I want to make an apology to you right here. It did not occur to my pea brain to put this list into your material, so I'm sorry for that. You can find it on the slides. They're on the member site. And you can also find it in the Waldron's book in a very handy format if you got it on the Till There Was No Remedy book. Yes, sir. That is exactly right. He knew. God knows those who are His, even in the midst of a wicked country, a wicked circumstance, a time. Far be it from God to destroy the wicked, the righteous with the wicked. That's a thing that's throughout the scriptures. And I think about, you know, Genesis 18. Abraham, even at that early date, has such confidence in God. Surely the God of all the earth will do right. Yes, sir. Yeah, that's right. That's exactly right. It did not. It was not something that he foresaw, evidently, that his people would sink to such a level. Certainly not something he would have commanded in any respect that people do such a thing. All right, so we got this list before you. I again apologize. But this is a good thing to learn. It is just a list of names, no doubt, but it is a skeleton of the whole period. So if we can get it in our minds, then it helps us to get the outline. It's something we can build and hang these accounts, these stories on. So let's see how we've done. We'll come back to this, I think, toward the very end of the quarter and do a little bit more work on it, so don't forget it. Bob Walden used to say that it takes 30 repetitions of a thing to make it part of your permanent memory. I'm probably somewhere in the late teens on this thing, but he said also that unless it's a bee sting takes about one and you got it. All right, so let's see what we can do with it. Jeroboam, Nadab, Baasha, Elah. Oops, I am so sorry. This is the chart we should be on. You are going to do great. Jeroboam, Nadab, Baasha, Elah, Zimri, Omri, Ahab, Ahaziah, Jehoram, Jehu, Jehoahaz, Jehoash, Jeroboam II, Zechariah, Shalom, Menachem, Pekahiah, Pekah, Hoshea. Okay. All right. So let's get into our questions. What prophecy was made at the dedication of Jeroboam's altar at Bethel? And what miraculous signs accompanied this prophecy? All right. Very good. Josiah, but that was very, it's a lot of names. And that's one of the things I think that really intimidates us. And it's, to be perfectly honest, it is hard with this period. There's a lot of names. There's names of prophets. There's names of kings. There's a southern kingdom, the northern kingdom, and it's condensed. And so it's really hard. But Stan said very well, altar, thus says the Lord, behold, a child, Josiah by name, shall be born to the house of David, and on you he shall sacrifice the priests of the high places who burn incense on you, and men's bones shall be burned on you. This was fulfilled. We read about it. It's about 280 years later in the days of Josiah. This is in the period of Judah alone, and it's in 2 Chronicles 34:5, if you want to reference it, that Josiah did, in fact, do this thing. What were the signs that accompanied this prophecy? Right, the ashes of the altar would be split, the ashes would be poured out, and this was done immediately. This happened in Jehu. There's the name. Jeroboam could see that, but still he puts his hand out, and what happens? It withers. He pleads with the man of God, pray that the Lord will heal my hand, and he does, and his hand's healed. And Jeroboam, he's very impressed by this. He seems very relieved. He's glad, invites the man of God to come back and eat with him. But it doesn't seem to have any lingering effect. He sticks with this sin. He stays right with it. And so he continues in. All right, what ended Baasha's dynasty? And why was the throne taken away from his family? Very good. All right, so what ended, we'll take it in reverse order, that what ended the Baasha's dynasty was that his servant, somebody he trusted, one of his commanders, came and conspired against him while his son Elah was on the throne. What didn't happen in the days of Baasha, it happened in the days of his son Elah. He was in Tirzah, drinking himself drunk in the house of Arza, the steward of his house in Tirzah. And Zimri went in, struck him, and killed him in the 27th year of Asa, king of Judah, and reigned in his place. And we see this descending into the power struggles. They're willing to murder one another to get power. And what a wonderful picture we have in Elah. God expected his kings. He gave them instruction through Solomon on this subject to be sober-minded. They had a responsibility to judge on behalf of God. They were to, what do we see Elah doing? He's drinking himself drunk. The people are out at Gibbethon. They're fighting against the Philistines. But he's not out there helping solve the problems, lead the battle. No, he's back drinking himself drunk. And as Tony said, because of all the evil that he did in the sight of the Lord and provoking him to anger in the work of his hands and being like the house of Jeroboam, and because he killed them, he wiped them out. That is, Baasha did. Well, what prediction did Elijah make to Ahab? This is 1 Kings 17. What does the New Testament tell us about this occasion? What was that prediction that Elijah made? That's right. There will be no dew or rain on the earth these years except at my word. And you think about that. We've had some pretty severe droughts for a month, 2 months, 3 months. But this is clearly the hand of God. Even I don't know if you recall that terrible drought we had for several years that culminated in 2007. You had dew. I mean, there were plenty of dews even during the drier periods. So when you have no dew, that's you, this is the hand of God. And it was, again, we think about those bales. What are they symbolizing? What are they're going to give you good crops. Well, they're not if you don't get any rain or dew. And so there was severe famine at this time. And God wanted the people to see that these bales to whom they had turned were impotent in providing for them. He, however, could turn the rain on. He could turn it off. And so what do we learn? What do we learn in the New Testament about that? In James particularly. Okay, not in James, but certainly he does make the rain fall on the just and the unjust. Yes, I think that's so, you know, Elijah, the point James is making here, Elijah was a man, as was said, like us. But he prayed earnestly that it would not rain. And I think that says something. God chose, as we look at these prophets, I hope you're impressed with their character, their concern for God and his people, and certainly Elijah. But more they are impressed and concerned with the reputation of God among his people and wanted his people to be in that right covenant relationship with them. So we see Elijah's not just going through the motions here. He's earnestly praying. He knew it was God's will that this happened. And yet here we see him earnestly praying. And again, when he prayed that it would rain, what happened? The earth produced its fruit. And so God is signaling loud and clear, the Baals can't do this, but I can. Your prosperity comes from me. Yep. All right.
Just like he did when he went up against the prophet.
It's a very, very good point. He told him, it's about to rain, Ahab. You better get to Jezreel because you're going to get cut off. It's going to rain so hard. That plain across the plain of Jezreel was notorious for flooding in that area, flat. But it wasn't raining. There weren't any clouds. Yes, sir. Yep. And he talks about it in the prophets. You went from one city. It didn't rain here. A little bit of rain over here. Not talking about this period. I don't think there was rain anywhere then. But many times there were times when he would, cut off the rain to show them, look, depend on me. It kind of reminds you of what he says in Deuteronomy 8:3. I allowed you to suffer hunger so that you'd learn where to turn. So what prompted Elisha's prayer for God to take his life? And then what mission did God give Elisha? It should be missions, really. Very good. That's right. His concern was with God. I have been very zealous for the Lord God of hosts, 1 Kings 19:10. For the children of Israel have forsaken your covenant, torn down your altars, and killed your prophets with the sword. And as Kevin said so well, I alone am left, and they seek to take my life. He felt alone. But again, we see his zeal for the Lord, his concern. God chose prophets who were not indifferent, but those who were concerned with God's covenant with his people. And then in 1 Kings 19:15, the Lord said to him, go, return on your way to the wilderness of Damascus, and when you arrive, anoint Hazael as king over Syria. And you shall also anoint Jehu, the son of Nimshi, as king over Israel. And Elisha, the son of Shaphat, of Abel-Meholah, you shall anoint as prophet in your place. So three anointings. And I think the message here is, you know, the best cure for depression is meaningful work on behalf of the Lord. When we get down, you know, the Lord has work for us to do. And when life seems meaningless and difficult, we're just not thinking right. We need to get busy. And that's what he had Elijah do here. Well, contrast the message of Micaiah with that of Ahab's prophets. We're in 1 Kings chapter 22 here. And which of these proved to be the truth? What were those other prophets saying? And then what was Micaiah saying to yes, sir? Sure. Mm-hmm. That's right. Elijah left the earth without all those things being resolved. And the message to us is don't forget that God's time, His perspective is different. You know, His thoughts are not our thoughts. His time frame is not always our time frame. And we get impatient. We need to remember that some things take longer to resolve. All right, somebody tell us what these messages were. Very good. Very good summary. And that's exactly what we see here. I find it interesting, too, that, you know, this whole thing looks like a setup to me. Ahab's got Jehoshaphat up there, and he's got one goal in mind, and that goal is to get Jehoshaphat to agree to go help him at Ramoth-Gilead against Ben-Hadad. And so if you think about the job of these false priests, these are calf priests, calf prophets rather, what's their job? Well, their job is to kind of survey the landscape, see what Ahab's up to, and then figure out how to back that up, make that happen. They were practiced in the art of deception. And Zedekiah is particularly good. He's not leaving anything to chance. As the young folks say these days, he was a bit of a try-hard. He had it in mind, I'm going to have me some iron horns here. And when, you know, they could see Ahab wants to go to against Ramoth-Gilead, wants Jehoshaphat to help him. And so he puts the iron horns on and says, with these, you're going to gore them. You're going to gore the Syrians until you've destroyed them. And so we just see that whole culture of deception. And Micaiah comes in there and Ahab sniffs out the, as you call it, the humor, the irony of what he was saying, and then tells him, no, they're going to have no master, no shepherd. That's you. You're their master and their shepherd. You're not going to be around anymore. The most puzzling thing about that account has got to be Jehoshaphat. I mean, he wanted to inquire of God, but then once he heard from God, he went on anyway. Very puzzling. When Ahaziah of Israel was injured, from whom did he seek information about his recovery? Beelzebub. Yeah. Now Ahaziah fell through the lattice, 2 Kings 1:2, of his upper room in Samaria and was injured. So he sent messengers and said to them, go inquire Beelzebub, the god of Ekron, whether I shall recover from this injury. It's puzzling that, you know, well, maybe not so puzzling that he knows he's got a prophet right there nearby of God, dependable, ignores him, doesn't want to hear from him, doesn't trust God, but he's going to go to a Baal. Well, wait a minute. In Samaria, he's got a temple to Baal. Why don't he just inquire there? He's sending them to Ekron. So as it turns out, this Beelzebub, master of the flies, as it were, well, what these people had done is they had observed that flies, which are very dependent on changes in the weather, they change with the weather so quickly, they seem to predict it. And so the master of the flies must be helping them out. So the master of the flies can tell you the future. He can tell you what's going to happen. Beelzebub was a god, they thought, of prophecy, an oracle who could tell them what was going to happen next. And so that's why he ignores his Baal and goes down to Ekron to, and think about this. Who were the Philistines? Their enemies. They had struggled with them for hundreds of years. They hated the Philistines, and it was mutual. And so what is he doing? He's sending his messengers down to the Philistines. And what a fine picture that is. Here's God's people who are charged with representing God, and they're sending the messengers down to these pagan heathen gods to get some oracle about what's going to happen next. It's just a very ugly picture. Yes, sir. Yeah. We'd already seen him show Ahab mercy when he humbled himself. And what do we know about God? He is consistent. Had Ahab been humbled before God again, God certainly would have recognized that. What motivated the Shunammite woman to show hospitality to Elisha, and how was she rewarded? Question 7. That's right. She recognized, as Tony said, I know that this is a holy man of God who passes by us regularly. And so she, you know, you think about our imperative in the New Testament. think not only on your own things, but also on the things of others. Well, she pretty well embodies that, doesn't she? She sees the man of God here. She recognizes him. She has a respect for him, but for God. He's a holy man of God, of Jehovah. And so she wants to make provision for him, to lighten his load. And she's very compassionate in that she does it. No indication at all. In fact, every indication that she had no ulterior motive. She wasn't looking for a favor, because when Elisha asks, he says, "What can I do for you?" The answer essentially is, "No, really nothing. I don't need anything. I'm in good shape." And yet, she was rewarded. She didn't think about that fact that she hadn't a son and that her husband was old. And Elisha tells her, "About this time next year, you will embrace a son." Well, we didn't get through all the questions. Encourage you to look over those. Matt will start us off in the Southern Kingdom on Wednesday night.